This is your host Helen and welcome to today's episode of Asian Bitches Down Under. It is my pleasure today to speak with Samantha On. Did I pronounce it correctly? I should have asked you before.
Totally right.
So Samantha is the founder and CEO of Joy Dolls. It is a boutique toy store offering the world's most diverse Asian dolls. I've came across with Samantha's work when I was scrolling through Instagram, just looking for gifts ideas for the end of the year for my nieces and nephews, and also I've got a young daughter myself, and saw her products and they instantly caught my attention, because you rarely see dolls that are ethnically specific on the market. And I've decided to click on the page and took a look through, and we connect, you know, that way. I'm really amazed with the range of the dolls that the brand offers. Samantha is currently resides in Toronto, Canada, and she's originally from our beautiful Melbourne. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Samantha. Thank you so much for joining me today at our podcast today. Maybe could we start with you telling us about yourself, your background, where you grew up, and what was your childhood like?
Oh gosh, that's a
lot of questions. Sorry.
How much time do we have? I was born in Malaysia, and then my dad decided, like, he got a job in Australia. He decided he wanted us to immigrate to Australia to give me a better life, like, and better education. So he got a job in Australia, and I was about 8 months old at the time, so pretty much like baby. I generally say, like, I was pretty much born in Australia. I was a baby, and so grew up in Australia practically, my entire childhood. It was only really until I started work that I decided to move to Canada. But before then, I was always been like a creative person. So I grew up in Melbourne. I do remember, like, being very conscious that I was Asian, that I was like the other. And I always thought, like, my classmates who were blonde, blue-eyed, were so much prettier. I wanted to be like them. I always felt that I couldn't get, like, a boyfriend or anything like that, because, I thought they were so much prettier, right? So, yes, I had that creative instinct. I always loved photography. I loved, like, designing online. And, the internet was coming in. I loved designing websites. And then, when it came to university, I was doing pretty well in school. Followed that, like, Asian stereotype, being good at math and all of that. And, like, even when I dropped chemistry, my teachers were like, "I can't believe you dropped chemistry." And, like, I just wasn't interested. I wanted to explore, like, digital media and stuff like that. And I remember, like, my teachers and, of course, my parents strongly, just dissuaded me from doing, like, that type of path. I remember them saying to me, like, "That doesn't seem stable, like, all the things, like, why don't you do something else?" So I didn't know what to do at all, because I just wasn't interested in anything else. And so, but I ended up just doing a commerce degree at the University of Melbourne. And I feel like when I did that, I didn't know at the time that it really wasn't for me, but I just completely lost interest in studying. And I just felt like maybe I was burned out, and I didn't realize that that just wasn't the career path for me. I just couldn't, like, click into, like, whatever was being taught to me. I tried, and just, like, I still continued down that path, because I just thought, like, that's what I had to do. And so I ended up in, I will say, boring all the insurance. And I did that for, too long. And that's when I started to get really bored. So that, I did that for almost 2 years out of university. And then I just completely didn't know what to do with myself. So I decided to move to Canada on my own. I just quit my job and then I just moved to Canada on my own. And then started that immigrant like journey on my own, mm-hmm. Like not knowing anyone. I actually moved like right after the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. So it was like really tough finding a job, but I was just determined to make a new life for myself. And because it was so hard to find a job, I ended back in insurance. Because that was all that my experience had to offer at the time. And so I did that, like, total, I did that for, like, 10 years.
Wow.
And, yeah, but in between, I started, I just knew that it wasn't for me. Like, I remember I just couldn't wake up in the morning, like, to go to work. Mm-hmm. I really dreaded going into work. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I just... I always loved photography, so my husband said, he was my boyfriend at the time, and he said, why don't you try doing photography? And I was like, oh, there's no way you can make your business out of it. But I decided to anyway, and so then I started a wedding photography business. Mm-hmm. And then I really felt like when I started doing that, like, oh gosh, this is exactly what I was meant to do my whole life. This, it all came down to this moment. I found my life, like, goal, and this is my passion. I loved it so much. I put everything I had, because I loved it so much, I put everything I had into it, and then it really became my life. So actually so much that it overtook my life. And then it was only until, like, it was so successful, and then, you know, I was working all the time, and then it was only until the pandemic happened. Like, even when I had my daughter, I didn't stop. Like, I didn't take any maternity leave. I was still working right through. I didn't take any break. And then it really took the pandemic to force me to, like, take a break. Mm-hmm. And I realized, like, what I was doing. And so it was like a blessing in disguise for me, even though, like, it was very stressful financially, because we relied so, you know, heavily on my income and, you know, providing for the family. Of course, my husband works, but it, you know, we, you know, both contribute, you know, equally to, you know, the finances and everything. So when I lost, like, practically 2 years worth of income during that time, it was, you know, pretty stressful. And I just thought, well, if I can't work, like, who am I? I really had to, like, peel back those layers, mm-hmm. and also rediscover myself as a mother that I didn't give myself the chance to when I was so focused on working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I'm just, like, sitting around, you know, taking on this, like, new motherhood journey, and I'm watching, you know, the news unfold, you know, during the pandemic, and, you know, rise in anti-Asian hate, and, like, all those, like, floods of feelings of, you know, being scared of how we look, being ashamed of, you know, where we come from because of all that sentiment that was happening, you know, around the world, and also what that meant for my daughter. I just was so scared that what kind of world is my daughter going to grow up in? Mm-hmm. So that's when I started to look into dolls, because we couldn't go outside, and we took that very seriously. So, you know, we didn't see anyone at all. So I started to look for, like, a playmate for my daughter. I was worried about her, like, getting along with other people and, you know, getting lonely, as I felt. So I was looking into dolls, and I just couldn't believe that there wasn't really anything out there that really represented us, even to this day. And I just, you know, like I had mentioned, thinking about my experience, like, playing with blonde dolls, and also having that connection to my classmates and saying, oh, well, they're so much prettier. Even on TV, we don't really see people that look like us of, you know, a certain of, you know, a certain position, or, you know, like, I just didn't feel like we were valued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had so much questions from what you said. What prompted you to choose Canada? Was Canada your first choice when you wanted to move out of home or away from your parents? Did you have any other options?
Yeah, so actually my goal at the time was to work in finance in New York. So I thought, like, let me get as close as possible to New York because it was during the financial crisis. So I knew that I couldn't just like pack up and move to New York and find a job, especially with the work visa situation and everything. Mm-hmm. And so it was good with Canada because of the Commonwealth arrangement. I could easily come over here. I think I came on like a working holiday visa. So okay, yeah. I was lucky that I was young at the time, so I could apply for that easily. So I took advantage of that, and then I wanted to move to New York. And then it ended up that I decided not to. that I decided, oh, you know what, I really do enjoy being in Canada. So then I stuck around in Canada.
Yeah. How were your parents' reaction of you moving so far away? It is quite a long distance compared, you know, it's not like New Zealand or, you know, somewhere near Asia.
Yeah, my parents were like, why don't you just move to Singapore or something like that? Or like even when I was thinking about moving to Sydney, actually, for university, I was planning to go to University of New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And they were even at that time like strongly against it, like, why would you want to move and all this? So they definitely felt that I was like abandoning them. They were really upset that I wanted to move all the way across the world. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be somewhere like close-ish. I had to be on the opposite side of the world. Mm-hmm. And at the time I remember like back then I had this obsession with New York, you know, with the Gossip Girl and all
I think we all did, yeah, back in our 20s, yeah.
So that was, you know, my dream at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I just realized, I think somewhere along the lines, I realized I just didn't want to work in finance and have that possible life.
Yeah, and it worked out well for you, I think. Let's talk about toys. That's what we're here for today. I don't remember much of the toys that I had when I was, you know, little. And because my parents, they were more focused in academic. I wouldn't say they're focusing academic side, but they got a lot more books for me and my siblings when we were growing up. Maybe one or two plushy toys for me and my sisters. My mom has this really extreme OCD about cleanliness, so she's like constantly cleaning, and plushy toys for her is like, oh, I have to wash it all the time. I remember I have this a female cousin who had a lot of Barbie dolls that I really envied back then. And I remember more of the social interactions with my friends, playing games outside, skipping ropes. So not much of the toys. What about you? What did you grow up with? Did you play with a lot of, you know, a specific kind of toys?
Yeah, I definitely Barbie was like the one I played with the most. And of course, there was Polly Pocket.
Yes.
Yeah, so those were the two ones that I played with a lot. And I even remember my mom got me this doll that it had like, you could, it was like pregnant, so you could put the baby inside the belly. And it was, I can't remember the entire of functionality, but it even like peed, like if you fed it like water, it would pee. And like, so I think dolls were a big part of my life, but even I was going back with my childhood photos, and I found a few photos of myself playing with the dolls, and they were all blonde. I think if I recall, there might have been like one brunette one, but definitely not like black hair or any of it, like various skin tone. When I was growing up, I was like a lot darker, like being out in the sun and all of that. And I didn't really think of it at the time, but now, like as an adult, like how we see stuff on media and stuff like that, and like especially in an Asian community, like we have this whole, like I shouldn't say we, but there is a perception that, you know, white is better, like like fair skin is better, like try not to get freckles on your face and all this stuff. And so even in the last couple of years, I started like doing like skin brightening and stuff like that. So and then even when I had my daughter, well, before I had my daughter, I was told like, oh, I hope, you know, she has your husband's Korean fair skin and all this stuff. So like, you know, it's like something that happens that doesn't really get talked about that much, but it's definitely prevalent, and that I don't want to continue that down the generation, and hope that we can change that narrative that, you know, all skin color is beautiful, no matter how you look, and, you know, also that whole, like, especially you saw this during the pandemic where, you know, there's that sentiment of, like, you know, go back to China, or, you know, there's all this perception that we're all Chinese. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I, because my family, my husband is Korean, and, you know, I'm Malaysian Chinese, like, I really wanted to, like, really celebrate our culture through the dolls. And that's where that idea really came about. Because my daughter was around, like, 1 year old, and it was her birthday, so yeah, we would put her in, like, her Korean hanbok, and then Chinese outfit, dress, and so I was like, well, we do this with, you know, our children, like, why can't she see herself in the dolls that she plays with?
Yes, I think the racial implications for the type of toys that the parents or their guardian choose is very important. It, you know, the kids want to play of what they, it actually represents themselves as well. Like you mentioned that when we were growing up, there's, you know, rarely any dolls that actually represent us. So we can't be what we can't see. So do you think that toy markets current society is too biased? Do you think that they're still very focus on a very monocultured, or is it very genderized? I do feel like it is very genderized, as in, you know, girls should play just this, boys should just play with that, and there's no a diversity of race representation in, you know, the toy industry. What do you think of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much excitement when, you know, big brands like bring out new dolls that are supposed to represent different cultures or races, mm-hmm. and always falls short, in my opinion, because when they finally do bring them out, they don't have that representation that I feel like we're really craving for, because mm-hmm. they still don't quite look like us still, mm-hmm. and in doing so, it makes me feel like, well, then if it still doesn't look like us, what are you trying to say? Like, if it looks like us, is it bad? Mm-hmm. So it almost does like the opposite effect, mm-hmm. because I still look at them and think, well, they still look Caucasian, mm-hmm. And what are we trying to say about that? Are we trying to say that, like, we should still look Caucasian? I hope that it will change, that that I hope that they will see that there is such a need for it, and that, you know, I'm thinking that maybe they're too scared to, like, dip into what they think is, like, a niche market, mm-hmm. but that niche market has been so it has been such a need for so long that and, you know, to think that we're so niche and that we're not valued enough to have something that really represents us is also, you know, telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit similar to the entertainment industry as well. You know, for a very long time that people of colors, actors and actresses hasn't been really presented on screen, and now the past 10 years, and it's kind of blew up, and, you know, the production companies finally realizing that there's actually a market for it. Everyone, you know, craving for seeing different sort of diversity represented on the screen. Let's talk about your creative progress when you're designing the dolls. How do you do the research, and how is it developed, and what's the production like? You know, from start until we see a complete doll.
Yeah, so it has been like quite the journey. It has been 3 years at this point. And so it has been that long because I have done such, like, so many iterations, and it has been such a learning process for me. At the very beginning, I didn't really fully conceptualize what I wanted for the dolls. I just wanted to get something out there. So I felt like the very first idea of the doll was very rushed. I just like had this idea. I wanted to do a Chinese doll, a Korean doll, a Japanese doll, you know, like have the different ethnicities. But I didn't really go into full detail about what that would mean or like, you like have a good vision for it. So only in time, I started to really have a better vision and like also know what our production capabilities were, because I had no idea. I have no like fashion experience. I've tried sewing so many times myself. I am horrible at it. I tried to do all my own research. So even though I didn't sew them myself, like I really learned like all like the different processes and like what was like possible and what was like not possible, especially in a larger scale. Because initially I actually had the idea of doing them all locally, like producing them all locally. Mm-hmm. And then of course, like costs were like just enormous. Mm-hmm. And most of all, I struggled to find the right skin tones. Like you would think that you could, in this day and age, then go to a fabric store and go, I want this color beige or this color brown. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't available. And then even just finding like, you know, for example, the Chinese dress, I wanted like red and gold fabric. And like, you know, it's very difficult to find that very specific fabric. So I had to take this idea overseas. And even overseas, it was like hard to find like very specific skin tones unless we customed them. So that's when like learning what we were able to achieve, like, and what we were able to do, like, and how it affected the end result, like changed, because initially I thought we could only do this type of doll, and then and that's why like the fabrics weren't that great, or like the design was very simple, and then realizing, oh my goodness, I can actually do a custom embroidery, or I can do like print out like the gold pattern that is on the Indian dress right now. Initially we thought that it wasn't possible. We had to find like the right fabric and then do it or stitch it in a certain way, but like a lot of the designs were all custom made, and so that's when I was able to redesign the doll in the way that we wanted it. And so
I'm just gonna throw to you at the moment, how many varieties of dolls that you have?
So we have Chinese, Vietnamese, Filipina, Korean, Japanese, and Indian, so six. Initially I had like the grand idea of doing I think I had like nine sketched out, and then potentially doing like non-cultural ones, like just like dolls in like everyday sort of outfit, or like modern or everyday outfits, but then it was just too enormous to do too many at once. Like even when I would talk to people like in the industry, like I would say I'm doing six dolls, and they're like, six? They're like, why don't you just start with one, maybe three? But I was super stubborn about it. Like I'm like, no, I'm gonna do six, because like of what I wanted it to represent. And what I wanted it to represent is that if when you look at the dolls together, you can really see that Asian diversity, like that we're not like one monolithic group, that we're all of different skin tones. And yes, I still want to develop more skin tones. And of course more ethnicities, but at least I could say like, look, even just with these six dolls, how beautiful they are together and how different they are. And they all have their own stories. And so I think, like, although it took much longer to do six, like I see other people bringing out like products like so quickly, like maybe like one product, but it took us so much longer, especially our production, because we did have such diverse products that we had to produce.
What roles do you think that emotional intelligence play in your work as a doll maker? You know, how do you feel when you're creating these dolls?
Yeah, so I really do hope that these dolls help people talk about our culture, and also just really normalize diversity among mm-hmm. children. So I really hope that these dolls aren't just for Asian children, that they are for all children to welcome into their home. I actually recently had a message on my Instagram. A mother reached out to me and she said that, you know, she's Caucasian, but her friends at school are all of diverse backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so when she saw the Indian doll, she immediately wanted to get the doll and was so excited to give this to her daughter, because she knew a lot of her friends were of Indian descent or South Asian descent, and that it would be so wonderful for her to have in her home, to mm-hmm. instead of just having someone that a doll that looked like her, that is so much more representative of the world that she lives in, but also we all live in. So I think that is so nice that, you know, these dolls aren't just a toy, that mm-hmm. they do represent so much more, that they can give so much understanding, and I really hope that it, you know, fosters a sense of inclusion for all people and all different types of look, you know. Because even my children, if I ask them which doll they like, they naturally, I never push them on any doll, but they love the Indian doll and the Filipina doll, which are the darker skin tone dolls. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're consciously aware of what, you know, what they're liking, or, but it, to normalize darker skin tones at this age, I think is so important, so that we can foster this world that really does embrace all colors. Mm-hmm. And what that could mean for, you know, for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I found that, you know, it's almost like educating from a very young age, because at the end of the day, when we start talking about racism, or the root of racism is really fear, you know, fear of unknown, you know, you don't know about other people enough, and then that kind of creates and builds up future repercussions and, you know, hate in between, or conflicts in the future. But I think that what you're doing now is brilliant, how you just normalize and including different sort of cultures and darks than the skin tones for the kids to know about. You know, it's all part of learning for the kids. Hi there! If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you are a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify, and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry. My next question for you is, you mentioned about the difficulties of sourcing different colors of fabrics when you're producing the dolls. Were there any other challenges or obstacles when you're running the business?
Yeah, I think for the most part, like I really wanted the dolls to be like as accurate in representing the different groups and ethnicities. So I was really worried at the time, like what people would think, because I can't like pretend to be, you know, Indian or Korean. Oh, sorry, not Korean. Even though my husband's Korean, but you know, I can't pretend to know. Be an expert in all the different cultures. And so I took that extra time to like really reach out to people, you know, in that community, get their feedback, take it back, like redraw, but also, you know, look at what's possible and then, you know, come up with a new design. Like, and then I even had people online, like, once people started following us, then we could like start to do like surveys, like what people think and stuff like that. So I even later on, I started to reach out to, you know, fashion experts in the in that field, in that yeah, like, you know, someone that was an expert in Indian design. So that was really helpful. But of course, you know, even in just say the Indian fashion, there's so many ways of how like to do it. And also, of course, like there's so many regions, like languages, religion. So there was just so much to learn. But also I had to decide like, well, what were we going to pick to represent as many children as possible in India. And so that even played a part with the name, like as something as simple as a name. I initially thought, oh, well, I'll just pick a name that I like. But then I was like, wait, I want it to really resonate with as many people as possible. So I actually had this suggestion from someone that was following us. Like in India, for example, there's so many religions, and but the, you know, main religion in India, like a majority of people follow Hinduism. So like a lot of the names were very related to Hinduism. So I had to be like kind of careful about which name we chose so that it would represent as many children in India. So then it was, I couldn't believe like how difficult that process was to find the right name. And yeah, so and that was so for like all the other names that we picked, but definitely the Indian one and the Korean one was the most difficult, because I even my husband who's Korean didn't realize that a lot of the names in Korean actually come from like have the Chinese characters in it. So finding like a pure Korean name that had like a non-Christian like connection was very difficult. So like all of that like caused extra time, but I think was well worth it to make sure that we did things in a way that, yeah, it was as representative as possible. But like, you know, like what's the word, you know, try to just do it properly. Yeah.
So it's so suitable for across the, you know, the whole representing the specific culture that they feel all
Yeah.
resonated to.
Oh yes, like do it respectfully.
And respectfully too. So my final question is that, are you working on anything new at the moment? Would you be creating anything new, dolls, or maybe a boy kind of dolls as well?
Yeah, we had so many ideas on what we want to do. Like I mentioned, I would love to do like different skin tones, because even with the six dolls, we've had so many people reach out and say, well, you know, I'm, you know, mixed. My husband is African American, and you know, I'm Chinese, and so my daughter is, you know, mixed. Like I would love something that looks more like her, or you know, like people have reached out like, oh, actually I have a curly hair and stuff like this. So there's so many ideas, because yes, even for myself growing up, like I have curly hair. I always felt like I was not Asian enough. Isn't that crazy? Like you know, had this whole mixed feeling of like I'm not white enough, but then I'm also not Asian enough. Like have all these like, you know, stereotypes. And so there's so many ideas that I have, but definitely the boy dolls have been such a huge request, but also like a lot of Southeast Asia. I think Southeast Asia as a whole has been sort of, you know, like not as represented as, like I say, the East Asian cultures. And so being able to represent, like especially the Vietnamese and Filipino doll, I think were so popular because people just haven't seen a doll like that represented them at all. And even people like from the Philippines or even from parts of Asia were like, oh my gosh, like there's a Filipina doll, like, and they can't even find that in the Philippines because all the dolls that they have there are also blonde. It's just crazy.
Very Caucasian-like, isn't it? Yeah, and also if you're thinking about like Southeast Asia, it's, if you come to think about it, it's not a very big place, but then again, it's very diverse. You know, you're talking about Thai, Filipino, Indonesian as well. Singaporean, Malaysia, it's just so many, you know, so many cultures that you can look into,
Absolutely, and I think that what's that's going to make it fun, but also difficult in like what we choose. So recently I did a survey, I put it out there for all the people that do follow us and to choose, and so I'm going to, the survey just closed, and I'm going to take a look at it soon to see what people want and then try to go based on that. But there have been so many requests because I think people really do resonate with the idea and love what we're doing and what we're about. Like, that, you know, we really are on a mission to just diversify the toy space and, you know, normalize this for children and change that narrative for the future generation. That, you know, we are proud to you know, embrace our culture and our heritage, and I hope that, you know, I can change that, you know, that for my children.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Samantha, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your insights into your work. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast. So where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, so you can jump on joeydolls.com. That's joeydolls.com. And then Instagram, just joeydolls as well. Facebook, joeydolls. And I think TikTok, also joeydolls. So it's just pretty easy.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you again. And hopefully we'll see more new products. And, you know, I'm hoping that our listeners will go onto your website and maybe order the dolls for this Christmas.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me and, you know, being able to share our mission and our story.